The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The former Fed chief told CNN she was, quote, wrong about the path inflation would take. In early 2021, Yellen said inflation posed a small risk to the economy and didn't think it would be a problem.
She was saying, basically, I was flat out wrong about the path that inflation would take. And obviously, Yellen was one of these officials that during the end of last year, as inflationary numbers were rising in every measure, said, well, look, this is probably because of supply chain constraints. And that's a big reason why the numbers that we're seeing as of the end of last year were so elevated. But at least now the acknowledgement from the administration, inflation was too high. Maybe some of that was because of the stimulus that was put in place during the pandemic.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. So thankful to be back with you. The audio that you just heard was from Yahoo Finance, and of course, this is the biggest topic right now, not just in terms of politics, but really in terms of kitchen table economics, household budget, which is inflation. Inflation has been running away at a high clip. Every single poll that we're seeing right now, the issue is really front and center for everybody. And we're not going to take a look at the politics of that so much, although there's certainly a lot of political angles to it. We really want to take a look at the economics of inflation, where it's coming from, where it's going, and perhaps what policy choices we should be making in terms of being able to contain inflation. Joining us to discuss this is Nathan Lewis. He is among the world's leading authorities on monetary policy and economic history. He's the author of The Magic Formula, The Timeless Secret to Economic Health and Prosperity, Gold, the Once and Future Money, Gold, the Monetary Polaris, and Gold, the Final Standard, a Discovery Institute fellow. His writings have appeared in Forbes, the Financial Times, and elsewhere. He publishes the Polaris Letter, a monthly investment newsletter available at newworldeconomics.com, newworldeconomics.com. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, good to be here.
Well, Nathan, I mean, I've written a lot about inflation. It's, you know, normally, under normal circumstances, writing about inflation is sort of like describing the paint drying slowly on the wall, right? I mean, because under normal circumstances, where inflation is really at sort of in that 2% target rate that the Fed likes to talk about, it's a subject, it's something that should be watched, but it's not very sexy. Unfortunately, the worse it gets, the sexier it gets, and so everybody's talking about inflation right now. What do people get right about inflation? What do people get wrong about it?
In the books, we break down inflationary factors into two basic categories. And it's real important not to think of inflation just as, you know, the CPI number. That's the kind of the measured result. But rather, right, macroeconomic processes. And there are really two going on right here. There's a wide variety of kind of supply-demand related issues, whether it be supply chain this or the tight job market or these kind of things, which have definitely added to the upward pressure in prices. And those are pretty easy to understand. It's supply and demand. And it doesn't really have anything to do with the currency. And the way to solve those, if they're a problem, as many of them are, you have to solve them at that level. And then there's a whole sphere of, actually it's really just one process, which is basically monetary in character, and it's not a supply-demand issue. It's not a shortage of some sort. And we find that the best way to understand it is simply a decline in the value of currency. And in the old days, they used to have silver coins, and silver coin would have 10 grams of silver in it, and then after the government was done with it, it would have only 7 grams of silver in it or something like that. Debasement of coinage has been going on for hundreds of years. But now it's all kind of virtual. We have floating fiat currencies, and the values go up and down in a somewhat chaotic manner, and sometimes they go down. And that definitely happened in 2020 as a consequence of all the very aggressive central bank activity surrounding the COVID event. So, and the common mistakes people make is they just mistake one for the other. They mistake a supply-demand event for a monetary event, and they mistake a monetary situation for a supply-demand situation. And we're getting both of these. I say, half the economists are wrong all the time. But today we actually have both things going on, so all the economists are half wrong.
I was just about to say, I think it's one of those situations, right, where maybe we're not as used to supply and demand issues, except for energy, which we'll be talking about later in the hour with our next guest. But we're not as used to supply and demand issues in terms of restricted supply in the United States. We don't really operate on shortage economies very often. Usually that's in times of great distress, of course, the pandemic being one of those. But I think the expectation was, certainly by last year, was that we were coming out of the pandemic and those supply issues, the supply and demand issues, would be, maybe not, wouldn't disappear, but would be properly managed. And that does not seem to have been the case.
No, I agree. It's very strange and unusual, and I think government is to blame for what we've seen. I look back for other examples where we had these kind of broad issues that affected the economy for months on end. I have to go back to World War II to find any other examples. So it's really unusual and not very healthy. Unfortunately, in some places, I think it's going to get worse, not better. But all those have to be solved at that level. You have to actually, whatever it is, drill for more oil or build more houses or this kind of thing. You can't just blame, you know, you can't just blame the Federal Reserve. There's really something going on there.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that. You know, I've heard a lot of people talking, well, the Federal Reserve is partly the cause for this. And now we're going to switch to monetary supply because this is a monetary supply issue. And what I would say is that you can make the argument, but you can't make that argument in a vacuum, because what we have seen in terms of monetary supply is really a result of a calcification of economic policy, which required the Federal Reserve to try to do some extraordinary things in order to generate growth. I'm not talking about the pandemic now. I'm talking about the aftermath of the Great Recession. And I think it was Politico. And again, we're talking with Nathan Lewis, who is among the world's leading authorities on monetary policy. And he has the Polaris letter at newworldeconomics.com. And if you've got questions about inflation, feel free to join the conversation, 888-914-9149. But about 4 or 5 months ago, Politico actually had a very interesting article about Thomas Hoenig, who was on the Federal Reserve Board at the time that Ben Bernanke wanted to start generating quantitative easing, which is basically an expansion of monetary supply. And there were several phases of this, and he was against it, and eventually he ends up leaving the board over it because the Federal Reserve really values unanimity, and so he felt like he needed to leave. And you can say, and he was arguing back in, I think it was 2010, when this policy was being debated, that what they were setting up were asset bubbles and the laying the groundwork for future hyperinflation on the basis of monetary supply expansion. How much credit do you give to that theory? And is this really a structural issue that is... Well, let me give you the second question a little bit differently. Is this a monetary issue that was created in response to a lack of flexibility on economic policy by the elected branches of government?
I think it took me a little while to figure out what was going on. Beginning in 2008, when all this kind of began, and central bank balance sheets around the world began to expand aggressively. And first of all, this process has been accompanied by very strange asset market performance. If you were involved in the markets before the 2008 crisis, there was a big change in the character of things. And I think currencies have fallen in value since that time. But the outcome has not been, for the most part, as inflationary as a lot of people feared, even though there's been some, as we have now. And what I concluded is that after the 2008 crisis, there was a big change in banking regulation. And banks basically got together in Switzerland and they made regulations that are in black letter to say that they had to hold a lot more cash than they did prior to 2008 because much of the financial crisis, because they didn't have any cash to meet obligations. And so they wrote some regulations that basically required banks to hold 10% of their assets in cash, approximately 10%. And you can go to J.P. Morgan's, you know, like annual report, and it says exactly what they're, how much they were required to do. And this cash is in the form of central bank deposits at the central bank, so that is part of the money supply. Well, once you have that requirement that banks have to hold this very large amounts of cash, billions of dollars, it has to exist, right? You can't have a regulation to own something that doesn't exist. So central banks had to create it. And the creation process was somewhat, they didn't really know what they were doing. They just sort of felt that there was a need. And so that is, that process is why there hasn't been as much inflation as Honig and some others have feared. But the one of the problems we have now is that's over. Banks, the phase-in process was completed in 2019. Banks are completely topped up. You can look at how much they own, how much they hold compared to their requirements. And so there's really no place I see that is going to absorb any more money creation that may take place going forward in the future. And now we have a political system that's addicted to this free money. It's essentially exactly what it has been for Congress. And if they try to do this again, we have a recession, like maybe we're starting to have already right now, and they have another cycle where they have big deficit spending, and they end up pressuring the central bank to pick up some of the tab for this with more money creation, it seems to have gone okay in the past, it could blow up in their face in a big way. And that's, we don't talk about that more complicated topic more so much in the book, but that's one of our motivations for going out with it.
Well, yes, and I think that this is part of the reason why it's hard to wrap arms around inflation in terms of a policy, because there's just been so many different moving parts to it. You've got the Federal Reserve part. You've got the massive spending bills that have come as a result of the pandemic. You have that final tranche, which economists were warning at the time was not really necessary, and which would exacerbate the supply-demand issues that the blocked-up supply chains were creating. And it's almost like you've had a perfect storm of choices here, not all of which were good, Nathan, that has created this inflationary wave. And when you're looking at that, as an economist, as somebody who is a student of this, how do you see that ending? I mean, what's the best way to get to a solution on this, and how long will it take to fix what's broken here?
When we mentioned that prices can be affected by non-monetary supply demand issues, and that's definitely true. But let's focus on the monetary side of things. And we found that the best way to describe the macroeconomic process, it's real simple to understand it as simply a decline in currency value. And this decline may come about by an increase in supply, which we have seen. It might come about from what amounts to a decrease in demand. And what that typically means is that the market looks at the situation. They say, you know, we don't like the way things are going. And so the currency may decline in value, even though there's not really much supply expansion going on. And that happened in the 1970s, actually. There wasn't much excess supply in the 70s. But if you just think about as a decline in the value of a currency and then the adjustment process that takes place afterwards, it's very kind of easy to comprehend that an example we use in the book is, let's take a look at the Mexican peso. It's more obvious when it happens to someone else. And the Mexican peso began in the 1990s at about 3 to the dollar. And today it's about 20 to the dollar, about 6 times higher. It takes 6 times as many pesos to buy a dollar today. Well, guess what happened to prices in Mexico? They went up over 6 times to compensate. I mean, and it's so obvious that it almost doesn't require an explanation. But that is basically the same thing that's happened to us, much less dramatically, with our currency. It declines in value from time to time and took another step lower in 2020. And there's an adjustment process as prices get marked higher to compensate. And the solution is real simple. Just don't do that. Don't have any further declines in currency value. And the way we accomplished this, we had a real effective system to accomplish this in U.S. history. It was the gold standard system. We linked our value of our currency to gold. We didn't put it up to, you know, it wasn't Jay Powell says this on Tuesday and Janet Yellen says that on Wednesday. It was real simple. It was just worth a fixed amount of gold. And we did it for over 200 years, became the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And as long as we stuck to that principle, we never had an inflation problem. So what we're really looking at is a failure of the entire institution of floating fiat currencies. And historically, they tend to end in disaster. We've avoided disaster for a long time. But I think if we have another round of this sort of money printing response and funding the central government habit that we've gotten into, it could start to get pretty disastrous.
Is it a realistic, is going back to a, a metals-based standard, gold, whatever it is going to be, gold, silver, platinum, gold would be the obvious choice. First off, is that realistic after nearly 50 years of fiat currency? And what would be the ramifications of that for people who are just trying to make their ends meet right now? I mean, I know, we could talk about the global economic impacts of that, but how would that impact people earning a living, trying to save up for homes and that sort of thing?
Well, a stable value policy is actually very common today. More than 100 countries in the world actually link the value of their currencies to dollars or euros. They're not floating fiat currencies. They have a policy where we just say whatever the local currency is going to have a fixed value with the euro, let's say, like a currency board. And that's it. And so there's actually a clause in the IMF which says that countries that are IMF members, which is all of them, are not allowed to link their currencies to gold. So euros and dollars is the best they can do. But for the United States in the past and all other major countries, it wasn't just the United States, it's the same basic idea. You link the value of your currency in a fixed official ratio with some external standard of value that you think is pretty reliable. A lot of people today think the euro is pretty reliable. In the past, gold was always the premier choice and really the only choice. There was no goofballs, making it go with lead or something like that. And so if you think about it that way, well, if over 100 countries can do that today, link their currencies to dollars and euros and other things, why can't we link ours to gold? Well, you can. It's not that hard. Politically, there's a lot invested in this floating fiat currency, economic manipulation, let's print money to fund the government system that we have. So like a lot of our deviations from the Constitution, not really easy to fix. But technically, yeah, it wouldn't be very difficult to solve.
It would, however, dramatically change the relationship of the federal budget to the issues of debt and deficits, right? Because at that point, it'd be very difficult to actually operate a deficit budget in terms of the annual federal budget, right? This would be something that would be difficult to do. And you would have then perhaps the reality of, roughly $30 trillion worth of national debt, primarily what we've rung up in the last 40 years. That could be difficult in terms of transitioning, correct?
I agree completely. We're in a political situation where we've kind of run this debt up on the premise that in the end, the dollars that we pay back aren't going to be worth very much. And you can actually see this in the statistics. Now, let me say the federal government can run large deficits under a gold standard system. And in World War II, it did so, although it was a little fuzzy at the time. Nevertheless, the value of the dollar before World War II and the value of the dollar afterwards was unchanged. And we ran deficits sometimes over 20% of GDP. So you can run deficits. But what has happened is outside of those extreme of kind of events, people were aware that you're going to have to pay the money back in real money, right? You can work on inflated away. You're not going to just pay it with the printing press. And they were pretty disciplined about it. Outside of wartime and U.S. history and the history of all the other developed countries, they balanced the budget in peacetime. Not perfectly, but pretty close. And then something funny happened right after floating fiat currencies emerged in 1971. We no longer have the gold standard system. In the United States and actually all around the world, all of a sudden, Congresses and parliaments started to run steady deficits, right? Year after year, for 2, 3, 4, 5% deficits. And that has what gotten us back to these huge debt levels, even without a war, right? In the past, GDP always went down during peacetime, and for us, it's gone up. And so I agree, absolutely. This is a large political hurdle where the temptation to say, you know, we have this big problem and let's just inflate it away is going to be ultimately be pretty strong.
So, Nathan, we've got maybe about a minute left. And again, we're speaking with Nathan Lewis, who is the publisher of the Polaris Letter at NewWorldEconomics.com, author of The Magic Formula, The Timeless Secret to Economic Health and Prosperity. And Nathan, just taking a look at the situation now, is there a possible path back to lower inflation without any of these structural changes, or are we basically now in a situation where a long-standing bill is coming due?
Let me say that actually the Federal Reserve behavior over the last, let's say, 12 months or so has been pretty good. They had a major inflationary response in 2020. Currency, the U.S. dollar, did decline, I believe. We're still experiencing the consequences of that. But the Federal Reserve kind of figured out, you know, we went overboard and let's keep things from getting worse. And they more or less have done that. So you can do that. And that essentially in the longer term, what Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan did in the 1980s, bringing the 1970s inflation to an end. But obviously, in this floating fiat currency environment, one thing leads to another. Nothing is very permanent. And I personally think, and I think it sounds like you have a similar view, is that we are in a time of reckoning, a window, let's say it's about 10 years between now and 2030 or 2032, where the can is just not easy to kick the can very far down the road anymore. And not only that, but the government is instead of reforming itself, doubling and tripling and quadrupling down with the craziest spending packages we've ever seen. Some of them have been blocked, but they're very ambitious about that. As if to get one last drink from the free money spigot before it all goes up in flames. So I think that we are going to struggle with this. And I think we're probably going to have a much more inflationary event than we've had so far.
Yeah, that's sort of been my very pessimistic outlook as well. And I certainly hope.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Now.
On Relevant Radio.
Right now.
On Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Joining me now to talk about one of the aspects, one of the most particularly noxious aspects of inflation is David Holt, talking about gas prices, energy policy. He serves as president of Consumer Energy Alliance, a trade association that focuses on expanding the dialogue between the energy sector and the rest of the economy, with more than 280 corporate members and 450,000 plus individual members representing every sector of the U.S. economy. Consumer Energy Alliance has become the voice of the energy consumer. You can find out more at consumerenergyalliance.org. David Holt, welcome to the show. Great to talk to you today.
How are you?
I filled up a couple days ago, so I figure I'm ahead of the curve by now, David. How about yourself?
Anything we can do to save a penny here and a penny there, because the situation's getting absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it adds up even here in Central Texas. I'm telling you, it's over $4 a gallon here, and this is not a state where you normally have high gas prices. And I've been in California last month or so. I was paying $6 a gallon there. I know it's worse than that now. The average price of gas across all formulations, the EIA released that information last night. The latest information is that it's $4.72 a gallon. That's the average price across all formulations. It is the highest it's ever been in nominal terms, even for
inflation adjusted. And I'm not sure if we still have David, but
I'm back. Yeah, I lost you there for a second, but I'm back now. Yeah, there we go.
So, yeah, I mean, the EIA, the $4.72 a gallon, this is one of the, it's the highest it's been in nominal terms. And again, inflation adjusted, it's almost a record, even in inflation adjusted terms. Frankly, what's the problem?
You know, and you're right. And I think we're setting record upon record upon record. And it's high oil prices, high natural gas prices, high gasoline prices, high diesel prices. So it's hitting us across the board. And with high diesel prices, of course, anything that's delivered by truck, then costs for those commodities, groceries, lumber, shoes, clothing, everything goes up. And there are three principal reasons for the high prices. One, the economy is coming back because of COVID. So we're driving more. Demand is going up a little bit for now because we're about to see that come to a screeching halt. Number two is the war in Ukraine and what that's done to global war oil dynamics and the U.S. banning Russian oil. Now the Europeans finally banning Russian oil. Number three is really the thing that we have control over. We can do something about it. And that's kind of the regulatory state here in the United States. And the Biden administration, obviously, when Biden was a candidate, he had a very antagonistic view toward oil and gas and announced that he would be fairly aggressive and announced plans to ban or restrict fracking and things like that. So when he came into office, they proved that out with banning Keystone Pipeline, with putting a pause on onshore and offshore permitting, with slowing down other pipeline permits, with not fast-tracking carbon capture and sequestration regulations, things like that. So what we could do and what the president could do today is fast-track permitting, get the Gulf of Mexico going again for leasing, get the onshore fracking going again, work with the industry to say, what do you need from me in the White House to, quote, do all I can, which is what the president keeps saying, do all I can to produce more here at home so we can put downward pressure on the price of oil and therefore downward pressure on the price of gasoline and diesel. We have the ability to produce 2 million more barrels a day or more than we are now. Back in 2019, we were producing about 11.5 million barrels a day. Sorry, 13 million barrels a day. Now we're producing about 11.5 million barrels a day. So what can we do to get that 1.5 million, 2 million barrels a day back on track immediately? That's the key. If the president and this administration were serious about it, they could move with due haste to make that happen, and we would see immediate relief in the price of the pump, immediate relief in the oil prices globally, and send a strong signal to Russia, to Venezuela, to other countries that were serious about our energy policy in this country, and we want to meet our own energy needs here at home, and we want to help folks, because the people that are hit hardest by these high gasoline prices are those that can't afford to pay it, the poorest among us, those living on fixed incomes, those people that this administration purports to support. They're hurting them the most, and this situation is atrocious, and unfortunately, it's likely to get worse.
Well, it's likely to get worse in part because the refining capacity is also declining in the United States. I mean, it's not just necessarily a production issue here. This is something I think that doesn't get a lot of attention. And I want to get to the refining issue in just a second. I want to stick with the extraction, exploration, and extraction issue first, though. And we're speaking with David Holt, president of the Consumer Energy Alliance. ConsumerEnergyAlliance.org is where you can find them. And we're taking your calls at 888-914-9149. But before we get to the refining capacity, let's talk a little bit about some of the hurdles that we have that maybe people don't know very much about. There is a popular misconception, David, that the oil industry is really run by three or four very large companies and that they have lots and lots and lots and lots of capital to invest in exploration and extraction, when in reality, the oil industry in the United States is thousands of small companies who need investors to come in order to do the to drill on these leases. First off, you got to get the leases. You got to cut through the red tape now that's been erected after Joe Biden's executive order 13990, which requires all sorts of new paths that you have to take in order to actually start drilling on lands. You have to do the geology, and all of this costs money and takes time. So once you've slowed this down, you're already behind the eight ball. This is an industry where capital has largely, that type of venture capital has largely been absent because of some reverses a few years ago. And the companies that need to do this aren't really attracting capital investment, in part because there's been a general hostility to the oil industry over the last several years, and investors are shying away from this. How do we fix that problem?
You know, you hit the nail on the head, and it's been a methodical approach to curtailing oil and gas investment. You're absolutely right. There are thousands upon thousands of companies that meet our energy needs, that produce the oil and natural gas that we need here and abroad. Increasingly, natural gas is a global commodity. Oil has always been a global commodity. But the United States has been kind of, in recent years, the swing producer. You know, a couple of years ago, we were the number one oil, number one natural gas producer in the world. But year after year after year, you're seeing these protesters, you're seeing these shareholder lawsuits that are going in saying that companies that are publicly traded should no longer invest in oil. You're seeing the Federal Trade Commission add more regulations. You're seeing regulations now around what's called environment, social, and governance regulation, which is another kind of financial requirement that says you will be a good corporate citizen, and that's largely defined by how little oil and gas you actually produce. The irony, the frustration here is that going away from oil and gas is not possible. I want to say that slowly. It is not possible to move away from oil and gas for decades upon decades to come. It's ubiquitous in our society. It goes into making everything from our clothing to our shampoo to aspirin to glasses to windows to carpeting. Literally every single thing in your home and your car is made with oil or natural gas. So quashing investment, quashing opportunities for further energy development really hinders the overall economy. It drives up prices for all of us. It stifles economic growth. It stifles job creation. It ripples throughout the whole economy. And if we're looking back on kind of the genesis for all this, every time you saw someone protest the Keystone Pipeline or the Dakota Access Pipeline or a pipeline somewhere else or a energy project here or now increasingly a transmission line, whether that transmission line is bringing electricity powered by natural gas or wind or solar, all those protesters who then go to members of Congress or elected officials at individual states and say, we are protesting this energy project. You need to be with us. Support this legislation or this regulatory policy. Those protesters are in large part to blame for our high natural gas, high gasoline, and high diesel prices today. You can't keep saying no to everything and expect that prices not go up. Now we're seeing people saying no to wind and solar and transmission lines related to wind and solar. The whole thing is ridiculous, and we need to recognize that this protest movement is really just a fundraising movement to pad the pockets of these protesters, and they don't support anything. We have shown in this country that we can do it environmentally responsibly. We're the leading nation on earth in carbon reduction already. We're the leading nation on earth in volatile organic compound reduction, particulate matter, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, every environmental measuring stick you want to look at, the United States is the leader on earth already. So we can do it safely. We can do it responsibly. We can protect the environment, and we can meet our energy needs. But there are those out there in this country that are trying to block our ability to meet our energy needs.
Well, and I think part of this is it's certainly part of this is unrealistic expectations of certain renewables or non-fossil fuel alternatives like solar and wind. And I think that people honestly think that solar and wind are a good idea. If you can install solar panels at your house, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that makes sense. The issue with solar power in terms of scalable production, though, is that there really isn't a scalable method for solar installations, right? The way you scale up on solar power is to add more installations. Whereas with oil, natural gas, coal-fired plants, and for that matter, nuclear power, which we haven't even discussed yet, those are scalable within a facility. You can scale up within a facility, and that's part of the reason why we do have these sort of limitations. We've been talking, even here in Texas, for instance, they've been talking about having to conserve energy. Some parts of the country are going to experience rolling blackouts with the summer coming on in order to really ration supply in the face of demand that can't be met at current rates of production. And if you're eliminating these types of things, either through regulation or through the discouragement of investment in certain types of energy sources, you're going to run into more of that supply issue, which is going to make things more expensive or simply not available.
You're exactly right. And it's, this is America in 2022, and we should not have, by my last count, there are 10 or 12 states that have already announced to their citizens that they will have planned brownouts or blackouts this summer. I mean, to me, that's just simply unacceptable, particularly with an energy-rich country like the United States. Listen, we Consumer Energy Alliance, supports wind and solar. We strongly support nuclear as well. We're kind of that all-of-the-above group, and right. Solar and wind have a valuable place. And we're proud of the expansion of solar and wind that we're already seeing. But for every wind project, for every solar project, you need backup power for when the wind is not blowing and the sun is not shining. That backup power could be oil. It could be natural gas. Largely, it is natural gas. Or it should be nuclear. So when you're having an event, it's nighttime or there's no wind, you have to have something to run the turbines to power to generate the electricity that then goes to your home. Natural gas is the easy solution because we have so much natural gas here at home. But you're seeing states that are banning natural gas hookups, banning new natural gas from coming into the state, banning pipelines, banning now nuclear facilities, decommissioning nuclear facilities, and kind of going all in on wind and solar, which is these are intermittent sources, meaning at some point they're not going to work. So what do you do when they don't work? And there's not enough either understanding of simple energy supply demand curves or how energy is developed or delivered, rather, or there's a intentional ignorance in how we're planning to meet our energy needs. Because fundamentally, what we've done in this country in the last, let's call it decade, really, is we've broken our energy policy. We have a fundamentally broken energy policy in this country because we focus so much on the only way to meet our environmental objectives is to deselect, either financially or via other regulations, deselect oil and natural gas. And that conversation is wrong. We don't need to deselect oil and natural gas to meet our environmental challenges. We can do both. And we can continue to expand wind and solar. On wind and solar, one of the concerns that we have is, and it's already announced, but most people don't know it yet, but to meet our energy needs with wind and solar, which, again, it's intermittent, so you have to prepare for backup power,
right,
but it's going
right.
to mean a tripling of the transmission lines in this country. So just imagine
yes.
the transmission lines that you see running through your neighborhood. Multiply those by three, and that's what it's going to take to get wind and solar from where the wind is blowing and the sun is shining to population centers. I don't know if the public, once it understands that, is going to support that either, because that becomes viewshed issues, right-of-way issues, eminent domain issues. all the things that go into that will become a, you know, kind of a public nuisance problem. So we need to make sure that everyone understands the balances and the objectives and the ways we can meet our energy needs and meet our environmental challenges at the same time. There's too much, you know, left hand versus right hand, and not everyone coming together to talk about sensible solutions. And that's a problem in our society in general, but in energy policy, it's really a problem.
We're speaking with David Holt, who's the president of Consumer Energy Alliance. You can find that at consumerenergyalliance.org. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the issue of refineries when it comes to gas prices, because we skipped over that. I want to come back to that. And then I want to talk a little bit about electric cars and where the supply is going to come for that demand when it hits the grid. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
It's 50 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of hotair.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We have a great conversation going with David Holt, president of the Consumer Energy Alliance. And you can find out more about Consumer Energy Alliance at consumerenergyalliance.org. And David, let's return back to gas prices, because this is the, I mean, we certainly get our electrical bills every month. You know, we get our natural gas bills every month. We're seeing those rates climb up as well. But I don't think we're seeing anything inflating as rapidly as gas prices at the pump. And gas prices at the pump have gone up about 91% over the last year. And even though we're still pumping a lot of oil, we are finding fewer places to refine that oil. And this is a part of the story here that I think isn't getting enough attention, is the role that the restriction in refining is playing in making our gas prices behave properly.
You're right. I mean, I think in the last 30 years or some odd, we've gone from over 400 refineries in the United States to maybe around 150, 142 last time I checked. Don't quote me on that exact number, but it's around there. So, you know, fewer than half the number of refineries, much fewer than half the number of refineries. Now, many of them have increased their capacity so they can move more refined product through. But by and large, we do have a situation where you get bottlenecks with refining our crude into aviation fuel and gasoline and diesel and asphalt and other refined products and chemicals and petrochemicals that go into pellets that go into, you know, carpeting and clothing and furniture and plastics and things like that. So all those things come through the refining process, and a lot of things that we wear and use every day are part of that. So fewer refineries mean, you know, you're kind of bottlenecked and pinched on your ability to refine your product. The other thing that's happened over the years is increased regulation, right? So just like in the extractive industries area, you're having more and more regulations on refining. Now, many of those are good and have provided benefits to society and helped reduce emissions, harmful emissions around the country. And our air is so much cleaner than when many of those regulations started in the kind of the mid-1970s, ramped up in the 80s, ramped up again in the 90s, and then ramped up again in the early 2000s. So the air is cleaner. The refined product is better. They're doing a very good job. But your point is right. Fewer refineries. We'll never build a new refinery in this country again. It just won't happen. Will not happen. So there's a lot of pressure on the refinery system, just like there's a lot of pressure on the extractive industry system.
David, we got a caller from Glendale, California. Manuel wants to join the conversation. Manuel, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What's your question, sir?
Well, my question is that we run around the issue, and the issue is that the current administration is the one that created all these issues in a short 17 months in power. You know, before this government that we have now, we had plenty of oil. The gasoline prices were low. It was all done in 4 years by Trump. But this man got into power, this Biden, and in less than 20 months, he has completely destroyed the economy. And the plan is to make it even worse. He even says that he's so arrogant. He says it's going to get worse. He's the president. How did Trump was able to get us into such a great position? And now this guy in 16, 18 months, he's able to destroy everything that the other guy has done. You know, and he blames everybody else. Yes,
Manuel. Thank you very much. I'm gonna put you on hold. I'm gonna let David answer that, and then I'll follow up. David, what's your response to that?
You know, a lot of people say that Trump is controversial, and I think that we all can agree on that. But he got
energy policy right.
he got energy policy right. He understood that energy is power. That there are geopolitical, global implications to having a strong energy policy in this United States. And we became energy dominant, were his words. And so we were producing more. The environment was continuing to get cleaner. He got no credit for that, but they did a very good job of continuing environmental progress. But we were meeting our energy needs and, importantly, exporting energy to other friends and allies. And we weren't importing Russian oil under Trump. So, Putin saw the geopolitical power of energy, and that's one of the reasons I think he chose to invade Ukraine when he did, is he thought the United States and Europe and their reliance on Russian energy, that ultimately we would blink. And, depending on how long this war lasts, if we get into winter, we still might see a blink. We don't know yet. But he definitely understood the power of Russian oil and natural gas. In this administration, I think the president had a slip of the tongue the other day that when he said that this is intentional, they're trying to raise the price
transition.
Of gasoline and it hastens the transition. Well, we're not seeing a hastening of the transition. We're seeing people go about their lives and try to conserve gasoline as best they can. They're making hard choices between a gallon of milk and a gallon of gasoline now increasingly across the country. But no one can afford an electric vehicle. The lowest cost electric vehicle is $50,000. Then they run up as high as $220,000.
You have to plug them into, a grid too, which means you have to have reliable energy sources. And we're not able to service the demand that's on that grid. Now, if you add tens of millions of personal vehicles to that grid, you're just not going to be able to power anything.
And the point you made earlier about brownouts and blackouts that we're seeing in 2022, add 10,000 vehicles to that grid in the current infrastructure, and think of the brownouts and blackouts then.
Yep.
Motors stranded because they don't have power to charge up their car. Like I said, our energy policy is fundamentally flawed. It is broken. This administration has intentionally hastened that broken policy, and we're hopeful that the new Congress comes in with a mandate that candidates now, frankly, regardless of party, should be saying, we're going into Congress, in the new Congress, and we're going to fix this broken energy policy. We're going to do 1, 2, 3, and 4 for oil and natural gas. We're going to hasten permitting. We're going to streamline it. And we'll expand wind and solar and offshore wind and get nuclear, as you mentioned, back on the table. There's a lot of things that both sides of the aisle should be able to come together and agree on, because high energy prices like we're seeing today is an economic killer. And we are slipping into recession. We all see it. And every recession since the early 1970s has been preceded by record high energy prices. And that's exactly where we are today.
That is exactly where we are today. David Holt, president of the Consumer Energy Alliance, thank you so much for being with us. Find out more at consumerenergyalliance.org. Just I want to give a quick response to Manuel. Thank you very much for calling in. I have good dear friends and family members who voted both ways in the election. I completely respect the reasons for that. And I don't want to necessarily say that one person is awful, the other person is great. There's certainly reasoned positions on both of those things. I think we can say, though, that the energy policy that's being pursued at the moment is not working and does need to be changed. And so whether this government does it or the next government does it, I think it's very clear that it's not working, certainly not working for working men and women going to the pump. And hopefully we will get that fixed sooner rather than later, and praying that we get more wisdom in our public policy on energy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.